Well, thank you. Thanks to the organizers to invite me to give this, to have this opportunity to present on behalf of myself and my co-author, Rebecca Fox. I'm going to be giving four examples of how technology has affected our ability to ask questions and to make measurements regarding nitrogen balances in soils. And I want to start out with a quotation from a paper. Just read a few of the lines from it. Regardless of years of research, an accurate soil nitrogen balance sheet for a field soil can seldom be drawn up. We usually lack quantitative data because of the experimental difficulties encountered in obtaining them. Although the main mechanisms of loss are probably known, quantitative data relating to each type of loss are certainly inadequate. You know, I think these statements pretty much encapsulate the state of the science today, and yet this was published in 1955. We've come a long way, I think, in understanding mechanisms, but we still have difficulty in coming up with nitrogen balances because so many of the measurements are so difficult. My first example is a historical one, not quite going back to 55, but nevertheless, I think an important one, in that gas chromatography methods were developed in the 50s and 60s, which enabled measurements of ambient concentrations of nitrous oxide. And because of concern about discovery of the stratospheric ozone hole in the 1970s, there was a lot of concern about supersonic transport airplanes and so forth, and suddenly a recognition that agricultural soils were an important source of nitrous oxide. And so this methodology, this technology was applied and in agronomy, in ecology, and other disciplines. In contrast, nitric oxide is a tropospheric pollutant that's involved in production and consumption of nitrogen dioxide and ozone, both of which are regulated now by EPA as a human health hazard. But these fluxes were studied primarily by the atmospheric chemistry community using chemiluminescence detectors. And these two communities did not speak to each other. They didn't even know about each other for a long time. I remember seeing some papers where agronomists were trying to use gas chromatography to measure NO, and it didn't work very well. But from a microbiologist's perspective, it makes a whole lot of sense to study both of those gases together because they're produced by the same nitrifying and denitrifying bacteria, and now we know archaea as well. And until we started studying these things together, it really was sort of like the blind men touching different parts of the elephant and trying to explain what they observed in terms of what's the effect of soil moisture, what's the effect of nitrogen availability, and so on. Since we were able to get those communities together starting in the 1980s and onward, we can try to understand, integrate the results of both the NO and N2O measurements so that we can say that, yes, sites that are more fertile, where you have more nitrogen flowing through the pipe in this conceptual hole in the pipe model, or because you add fertilizer, those places are going to have high emissions of both, perhaps, but the end product of these processes, whether it's nitrification or denitrification or the two combined, is related to the redox of the soil, which is related to soil moisture. So whether you'd expect NO or N2O or even N2 as your dominant end product, you have to consider both site fertility and soil moisture content or other indicator of redox in order to understand the variation that we see temporally and spatially. So that's a historical example. We have new technologies, laser technologies, and this is just one in a proverbial black box that we have connected to a LIQOR analyzer. And that is connected to an automated soil chamber system. So when I was a graduate student, I had to carry out my bag full of syringes, and I put my chambers on them, and I would fill up four syringes for each chamber. And if I was lucky, I might get a couple dozen flux measurements made in a day, and I would have four data points for each flux measurement. Now, I have hundreds of data points for each flux measurement made within 3 minutes. And so the chamber is only down for 5 minutes. That eliminates a lot of, or reduces, not eliminates, minimizes some chamber artifacts. Although even here you can see that there's some non-linearity to this plot, so there probably is a chamber artifact. But with all of these data points, we can move quite quickly between chambers, and they keep, so we can cycle all 8 of our chambers or so within an hour and come back and start them all over again. And so we get very large data sets and pretty high confidence in slopes such as this. You'll notice this one is a negative slope. This was uptake of N2O. And I used to throw those data out usually when I was doing work with gas chromatography, because I only had 4 points and they were usually kind of scattered around, and maybe there was a little bit of a negative slope, but it was seldomly significantly different from zero. Now, even with something like this, where the change in concentration in the chamber headspace over 5 minutes is only 0.1 ppb, because I have enough points here, I can say that with 95% confidence that that slope is significantly different from zero. So now we can be sure that those negative fluxes are real fluxes, and now we can ask some different questions. And also, we can use this technology for eddy covariance measurements. So now we have a whole new ability to look at spatial variation in another way. So there's too much data here to show to explain, but I want to make a couple of points. So this is from the Howland Forest, a nitrogen-limited forest in Maine, measuring CO2, methane, and N2O across a season here. And in wetlands in red and uplands in black, and as you'd expect, more CO2 in the upland than the wetland. Wetland is a source of methane, the upland is a sink for atmospheric methane, and for N2O it's mixed. The wetland is a sink for atmospheric methane. In the upland starts out as a sink in the spring when the soil is fairly wet, and then it becomes a source as it dries out a little bit. And so the interesting thing with this is that there's a period of the year when the same soil is both a sink for atmospheric methane, that's an oxidative process, and a sink for atmospheric N2O. And if it's classical denitrification, that's a reductive process. So we have oxidation and reduction occurring at the same time. So now we have to ask the questions, well, how could that be? Well, of course, it's microsites. Microsites are the last refuge of scoundrels. We can explain anything by microsites. But can we do that in a numerical model, which is now what we're trying to do? And I hope maybe next year I can come back and explain that, how we're dealing with microsite heterogeneity in a numerical model. So it allows us to ask, or prompts us to ask, new questions with these tools. So moving on to my third example is the work of my co-author, Rebecca Fox, in her dissertation. She used MIMS, which a method that was developed by aquatic ecologists to measure nitrogen fixation and denitrification in sediments. There, you have an advantage that nitrogen is sparingly soluble in water. So different situation than what we deal with in air. But what they did is use MIMS to they took this method that had been developed by the aquatic ecologists and used it to study groundwater. So they measure N2, O2, and argon. Argon is used to calculate the groundwater recharge temperature. Argon being a noble gas, there's no biology, you know what the concentration should be related to temperature. Then use that temperature to calculate what the background N2 would be if it were in equilibrium with the atmosphere. And then you measure N2 concentration, and any difference is considered N2 excess. So, but you have to know what the background temperature is quite precisely, and the argon allows you to do that. So she did this on the Delmarva Peninsula as part of her dissertation, along with other studies on N2O, to try to combine the N2O and N2 measurements. In this study, I want to show preliminary results from work in Brazil, in the southern part of the Brazilian Amazon, and a huge ranch that is been converted. It was originally used for cattle grazing. Now it's primarily corn and soybean. And we have these various watersheds that are in either forest still or corn or soybean. And we went to one of these watersheds where we have hydrologic measurements and stream chemistry measurements, as well as chamber measurements in the field, and go to the riparian zone, and in that riparian zone measure along wells and along a gradient from the edge of the field into the center of the stream. And there is Rebecca and a colleague taking samples from within that riparian zone. And here's an example of measuring from the stream along that gradient. So P1 is out here, in the stream is down here. And did this in both the wet season and the dry season. And indeed, there is considerable excess N2 in the groundwater, but it probably degasses as it moves towards the stream, and eventually into the stream it completely degasses. It's higher in the wet season than in the dry season. There are fewer measurements made here in the dry season, only three. But the trends across that whole ranch make a lot of sense, in that here's some averages that values are, concentrations are lower in the forest than they are in agriculture. That makes sense. They're generally lower during the dry season than during the wet season. That makes sense. And so just taking some averages and back-of-the-envelope calculations, we know that overland flow is very low there. So most of the stream discharge is fed by groundwater. If we assume that the excess N2 on average that we've measured in the groundwater that is approaching the stream, entering the stream area, and use that, multiply it by discharge rates to estimate a flux of N2 degassing, and then divide that by the area of the agricultural field that's receiving, that stream is draining, we get estimates in the order of tens of kilograms per hectare per year from the cropland of N2 losses in this way, and somewhat less from the forests. On this same field, and this is my third example of you, or fourth example now, of using stable isotopes, we take advantage in this same ranch that it was converted from C4 pasture grasses for cattle grazing to soybean. And so we had, and it was being done gradually over time, so we have a chronosequence of when the area was converted to soy, plus we went back and resampled in 09 and in 13, so we have two data points for each chronosequence. Not all chronosequences are perfect. This one had less clay content than the others, so that's the danger of doing chronosequence studies. But because we had repeated measures, we could deal with that. Carbon stocks declined a little bit over time, but not statistically significantly. But C13 declined, as you would expect, as you go from a C4 plant to a C3 plant. For nitrogen, nitrogen stocks increased slightly, but not significantly. But N15 declined significantly in 3 out of the 4 cases, and overall in an analysis of variance, as you would expect if there's nitrogen fixation bringing in atmospheric N2 being fixed from the atmosphere. Interestingly, the CN ratio, did that change, was statistically significant. So taking these data and other ancillary data, and I obviously don't have time to step through all these steps of how much above ground biomass was reported by the harvest and so on, and estimates of how much is in roots in the soil. But with those constraints of the changes in both the stocks and the isotopes, we can finally come up with some estimates of inputs from the N fixation from the soybeans, and also some constraints on soil losses. And the paper goes into the error terms on these constraints. But interestingly, we come up with an estimate of nitrogen losses on the order of a few tens of kilograms per hectare. We've done measurements of N2O on the surface. It's less than 1 kilogram per hectare. The stream export is on the order of 2 or 3 kilograms per hectare. So normally you'd quit right then and say, well, we can't figure out where the rest of it goes. But now we have some N2 measurements from from the groundwater and can infer that maybe that difference that we normally would sweep under the rug and say we can't make our nitrogen balance add up, that we can say that perhaps it's due to N2 losses from the system via hydrologic export. So I hope I've given you a few examples of the importance of the technology and our ability not only to make measurements, but the kinds of questions that we can ask in our investigations. So the first example was a historical one about how important it was to bring together different communities that were using entirely different technologies to make their measurements in order that we could make our measurements together and understand the consequences in terms of their relationship to the biology or the microbiology. The new technologies also not only greatly improve our precision so we can be more and accuracy so that we can be more confident when we do detect small fluxes or have some results that are somewhat unusual, and then enable some new questions about trying to understand what's happening at microsite levels. Borrowing technology from a totally different discipline of aquatic ecology and trying to figure out how to adapt it to groundwater in a terrestrial system allows us to put some bounds on a pathway of nitrogen loss that we couldn't possibly measure before. And combining that with the mass balance isotopic approach, we finally have at least a first cut at a nitrogen balance that gets past that enigma of not being able to measure nitrogen balances. Of course, this is an unusual circumstance where we were able to deal with, we had an isotopic signature that we could deal with, and also applying in watersheds that we knew that most of the stream water was fed by groundwater. But I think combining these gives us a first approach, at least, to be able to address that enigma of measuring nitrogen balances in agricultural systems. So thank you for your attention, and if there's any time, I'd be happy to answer questions.
We have time for a couple questions.
Yes, sir.
As you've clearly worked on this a long time, thank you, by the way, for a really nice talk. This isn't my core area, but I can follow your talk, so that's good. Has your work over the years led you to make recommendations to agriculture for how we could fertilize to minimize losses? We can put on ammonia, we can put on nitrate, obviously, we could try to put on less. This is a really applied aspect.
Right. Well, it certainly puts us in a position to work with partners who are doing that very thing. So, for example, there's the nitrogen fertilizer industry that's working on the 4R approaches to recommendations of using the right product at the right time, the right place, and the right amount. Did I get them in the right order? I don't know. But there are environmental organizations, Environmental Defense Fund, they have a booth here, an Energy Star program that's trying to work with farmers and crop advisors to come up with that information. Field to Market is another one that's working with growers to try to come up with protocols for how they could get credits for reducing nitrous oxide emissions, for example, and then ultimately linking it to nitrate leaching as well. So there are many players out there, both in industry and in NGOs, and they are engaging scientists, including scientists like me. I certainly don't claim to be the extension agent or the person with the right recommendations, but working together, I think we're gradually making some progress in that realm.
It's pretty interesting that you get a lot of nitrogen losses from porous soils.
Right, of course, remember, this was a tropical forest soil, and that's a little bit different, I think, than temperate, although there's some intriguing estimates of really high N2 emissions from Hubbard Brook Forest in the literature, and that's through another technology of where they use soil cores and they introduce a they replace the oxygen with hydrogen and circulate it. Well, you know, we need multiple technologies to try to make these estimates to figure out which one of them has strengths, and they all have strengths and weaknesses, but to compare those strengths and weaknesses to have confidence in the estimates.
Okay, we better move on.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.